Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscowane. Handsome and troubled ad man Don Draper catapulted himself into the hearts of fans in the very first episode of Mad Men with this cynical line.
What you call love was invented by guys like me to sell nylons.
And those nylons Draper and his colleagues are selling were invented right here in the Delaware Valley, along with a myriad of other products that forever changed fashion and interior design. The popular series, about to go into its fifth season, has sparked a retro fashion and design craze. And on today's show, we'll talk about the role of the Delaware Valley chemical industry in creating many of the products we see on the show. We'll also discuss the future of design and the textile industry in our region and the latest in textile development. Joining us in the studio are Regina Blaszczyk and Genevieve Dion. Blaszczyk studies the history of science as a visiting scholar at the University of Pennsylvania, and Genevieve Dion is fashion design program director at Drexel University's College of Media Art and Design. She's an award-winning designer and will be in charge of a brand new textile lab that we will discuss during the show. Thank you so much for being here today on Radio Times. And of course, if you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Reggie, let's start with a bit of history. How did this region become such a hotbed for chemical companies?
Well, Philadelphia was a major manufacturing center from its start in the 18th century, but in the 19th century, it became really the major textile manufacturing center in the country. And when you have textiles, you have the need for chemical industry to serve that textile industry. So we saw major chemical companies established here in Philadelphia and in the Delaware Valley, going all the way from really the mid-Atlantic coast, going all the way from New Jersey down to Delaware.
And what were the most important inventions coming out of this region?
Well, I think in terms of fibers, we see the invention of nylon, as we heard Don Draper explain to us a few minutes ago, and other synthetic fibers. But we also had important innovations in paint technologies and in plastics as well.
And paint technology, you're talking about acrylic paint, right?
Yes. Acrylic paints were invented and developed and commercialized in this region by two companies, the Roman Haas Company, which is now part of Dow, and by the DuPont Company.
And I want to, actually, the companies then having these new products had to take a very active role in pushing these products out to consumers. And I want to listen to, we have a vintage color commercial or a paint commercial that I would like to take a listen to. Let's hear that.
Match any elusive shade. Choose any subtle tone. Any color you've ever wanted is yours with Robilac Colorizer. A never-before range of colors and shades as possible. Color and more color. Colorizer, so simple to buy, so simple to use. Into the white base paint goes all the colorant from the tube. It's as easy as stirring milk into tea. In 30 easy seconds, the exact...
So they are really explaining what you can do. Reggie, talk a bit about what was painting like before these colors came on the market.
Well, in the early 20th century, you had a paint industry that used oil-based paints and had sometimes often toxic ingredients in them, such as lead. And there have been a lot of controversy about that subject lately. But in the 1930s, you saw the development of alternatives to those kinds of paints. And really, those alternatives really blossomed in the post-war years. Those technologies are really based on acrylic technology. And DuPont and Roman Haas were leaders in that area.
And that allowed then people to paint themselves and to also change their minds frequently, I guess.
Yes. In the early 20th century, most people did not spend Saturday afternoon painting their parlor. They would have to hire a professional paint team to come in and repaint the rooms or the exterior of their house because the paints had to be mixed professionally. There were some exceptions, of course, but for the most part, you needed a professional painter. By the 1950s, however, you had an enormous do-it-yourself movement that was involved many kinds of new technologies and products, and one of them were the do-it-yourself paints that many of the major paint companies such as Benjamin Moore and et cetera, manufactured using the ingredients that Roman Haas, for example, manufactured.
And talk a bit about the marketing of color psychology. There were color psychologists who were traveling around the country and explaining this, and that was DuPont doing that.
Yes, DuPont was a major pioneer in the application of color psychology to paint marketing, beginning in World War II, interestingly. It was believed that by painting factories, the interiors of factories in certain colors that were calming and vision enhancing, that you could increase efficiency in the factories during World War II. DuPont capitalized on this theme and brought it into the general commercial market in the post-war years. A major consultant to DuPont along these lines was a guy named Faber-Biron, who was probably the foremost color psychologist of the mid-20th century.
And Geneviève Dion, you are an artist and a designer. So what's your take on color psychology and how the color of the wall impacts how we feel and how we work?
Well, for us, I think if we think about designing clothing, the neutral of our walls would be very important so that you can really assess the colors that you're wearing and you're working with. Because, of course, those colors will influence what the color of your garment looks like. So we like neutral environment in order to pick the color for the garment and to see how they react, and they go together.
And how do you think about color and mood when designing garments? How does that come into play? Or when you dress yourself in the morning?
Well, designer mostly wear black, as we all know. So I would be one of those who do the same. But colors really matter in terms of mood. So if you do a mood board, you will think about how you put all these colors together and what inspires you. So you're inspired by the sand or by the water, and then you start picking your colors in relationship to that and try to match that. Sometimes you have to go and try and find the fabrics that have already been pre-dyed, and we have other, of course, those who have them dyed especially for them, and you can have large dye colors that are very similar to the paint chips for the fabrics.
Mm. That's Geneviève Dion. She is Fashion Design Program Director at Drexel University's College of Media, Art and Design. And we also have in the studio with us Regina Blaszczyk. She is a historian and a visiting scholar at the University of Pennsylvania. And you write about the history of the chemical industry in this region. And that's a bit about what we're talking about today, is both the history and the future of the chemical inventions and design in this region. And now I do want to move on to synthetic fibers, even though the topic of colors is fascinating. But the fibers really changed a lot of things, among them fashion, right, Regina?
Yes. DuPont was the major producer of synthetic fibers in the world in the post-war years, from about 1945 through 1980 or so. And it introduced a family of fibers with products that replaced traditional fibers. For example, one major product that it produced was acrylic fiber, which was a synthetic replacement for wool. It also introduced Lycra spandex in the late 1950s, which is a product that is with us today. I think something like 80% of U.S. Clothing that women wear in the United States in 2010 include spandex. So it makes these new technologies were replacements for older fabrics and introduced new characteristics, and that they were innovative in that way.
And what are the advantages of those fibers and some of the drawbacks? And you can both weigh in on that.
Well, the advantages of acrylic fiber, for example, would have been, the major advantage was that it was moth-proof. If you've ever had a moth infestation, you know how troublesome that can be, and that was a problem. It was also washable. Wool, of course, is washable, but this was more washable and easier to care for. Spandex was stretchable, so you could, for the first time, create undergarments that were easy care and stretchable and moved with the body. So you've got major care innovations and performance innovations.
And Geneviève, how did that then impact what designers can do?
Well, as you said, you know, most of the garments that women wear today have spandex in them. Of course, it's never 100% spandex. It's always maybe 3 to 5 to 10% spandex. But many, if you think about your denims, Every pair of denim today, almost 90% of them always have spandex in them. So they're a lot more comfortable, more easy to wear. Shape retention as well as comfort is a really important thing. So spandex is in a lot of the garments that we wear. If you look at your labels in your garments, you'll rarely you see 100% something. Sometimes you will, but most of the time now you'll see a blend of some kind. And that has to do with the advancements of textile. So you'll blend some linen with some polyester. So you get the advantage of the linen, but then you can reduce the cost and so on and so forth.
And Regina, how did consumers react to these early versions of these fabrics? Because they were often not blended. And I even remember from my childhood that polyester was often really uncomfortable because you were sweaty.
Well, consumers responded positively because they bought the new fibers initially, but as the marketplace became more competitive and more textile manufacturers and garment manufacturers became involved and competition came from overseas, the quality of some of these fibers began to decline. So when you talk about the polyester era and the era of double knit, you might say that double knit was kind of a fashion faux pas. And so, but it's all really, that's all really a function of the new territory adjusting itself, and it's part of kind of the product life cycle.
And talk about how these inventions impacted the price of fashion, because if we compare, you all you have to do is look at a closet in a Philadelphia house, an old house, and you know people didn't own a lot of clothing in the about 100 and 120 years ago. So how did it impact how much clothing we owned, what we could buy?
I think the impact, new fibers did have an impact on increased consumption. I think initially they were more expensive than some of the natural fibers, but as the market became more competitive and more fiber makers entered the market, the prices, of course, began to fall, and this enabled more of the democratization of clothing.
And Geneviève, what are the characteristics of a good fiber? What makes, what do you want to see?
Mm. Well, it depends on what you want to use it for. So again, the things that I find interesting about textile is always there's the advantages and the drawbacks. So you always have to choose depending on. So you want to make an evening dress. You're not concerned about it being washable. You need to wear it, but you will choose the most beautiful fabric that drapes the best. A $30,000 evening gown will only be worn once, so the idea that it needs to be washed or cared for is not really the principle. But if you want to work out every day, you want to be comfortable, you want your fabric to wick the moisture away from your body, so that's a different fiber altogether.
We're going to take a short break here on Radio Times. We're talking fashion, design, history, and future here on today's show. Our guests are Regina Blaszczyk and Geneviève Dion-Blaszczyk. She studies the history of science as a visiting scholar at the University of Pennsylvania, and Geneviève Dion is with Drexel University's College of Media, Art, and Design. We'll be back after a short break.
Supporting WHYY, Drexel University's MBA in Healthcare and Pharmaceutical Management was designed for healthcare professionals looking to manage delivery systems and executives in the pharmaceutical and life sciences industry. Drexel developed this program with industry representatives, and the curriculum merges business strategy with science and technology. Learn more about Drexel University's online healthcare MBA. Details online at drexel.com/open house.
After eking out a victory in the Iowa caucuses, Rick Santorum has racked up a few more wins along with some momentum. Now he's looking for an upset in Mitt Romney's home state of Michigan and another state that appeared to be a lock for Romney, Arizona. I'm Robert Siegel. On Tuesday, we'll bring you results, reaction, and analysis, special coverage of the Michigan and Arizona primaries from NPR News.
Tuesday night at 9 on WHYY.
The Discover Newsworks Discover the Philadelphia Region sweepstakes. Newsworks.org is giving away great prizes to our Facebook fans. This week, tickets to see two upcoming concerts at Union Transfer. Search Newsworks.org on Facebook and enter weekly. Share with your friends for extra chances to win. You must like Newsworks.org on Facebook to enter. No purchase necessary. For a complete list of rules, go to Newsworks.org. Newsworks.org, powered by WHYY and you. Smart. Local. News.
And welcome back to Radio Times. We're talking about the rich history of the chemical industry in our region today, its impact on textile design and on fashion, and we're also talking about some of the future that we're seeing happening right now. In the studio with us are Regina Blaszczyk and Geneviève Dion. Blaszczyk studies the history of science as a visiting scholar at the University of Pennsylvania, and Geneviève Dion is fashion design program director at Drexel University's College of Media, Art, and Design. She's also an award-winning designer herself. And we would love to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that's 1-888-477-9499. For example, I'm wondering if you out there are synthetic fabric people or if you love your natural fibers. That always seems to be a debate when people make their shopping decisions. But before our break, we were talking about all these new fibers, synthetic fibers that came on the market and that really changed fashion, but they also changed a lot of other things. For example, again, interior design. And I want to hear another commercial that we found online, another vintage commercial this time for carpeting.
This is the carpet that loves kids. Even kids on roller skates. Textured Caprolan nylon carpet. So beautiful with its rich texture, heavenly colors. Looks like a carpet you'd have to pamper. Yet wears better, cleans easier. And we proved it here in New York's Penn Station, where more than 1.5 million people tramped over this piece of Caprolan. See? It clean, fresh as new. No sign of wear. While other kinds of fibers wore right down to their backing. That's why beautiful, practical carpets of textured Caprolan nylon belong in your home.
Well, I don't know about that. I'm sure that nowadays people would not want to have a nylon carpet in their home. However, I'm sure that the carpet that is in this studio is probably nylon. So, Regina, talk a bit about where else do we see these fibers show up?
Well, I think you're right to point to the architectural market because synthetic fibers are blended with other fibers in upholstery, for example, that is in all the chairs that we sit in. And when we go and get on an airplane, we sit on chairs that are upholstered in a synthetic fiber blend, and we walk down the aisle, and it's a nylon carpet of some sort. So the interior design field is very important to that.
Now, we heard the qualities that were emphasized in this commercial, durability being the big one. Mm-hmm. Is that what these inventors set out to do, to create a fiber that looked like something we knew but was mm-hmm. different? Or what were their motivations in your mind?
Well, I think that when DuPont first invested in the research that led to the discovery of nylon, they were looking for a fiber that could replace silk in ladies' stockings. So they were looking for a silk substitute. Acrylic was a wool substitute. Yeah. So there were a lot of substitution drives that were motivating these early fiber innovators.
Yeah, historically, they tried to imitate the natural because that's what we knew. That's the history of the fiber that we knew. They responded well to different types of dyes, chemical, and so forth. So to try to imitate those prized fiber, especially silk, because silk is very, you know, cultivated silk is very rare. It's difficult to produce. So the prized fiber to imitate was silk. But nylon in the carpet is also interesting because I don't know if you remember the very old carpet with the electric, the static electricity mm-hmm. and so the sparking. And that's what is so fascinating about textile and technology is that they started to blend ecstatic fiber that have silver in it to take the electrostatic charge out of nylon so that it would no longer have the static electricity. So always continue to say, well, we've invented nylon, it's wonderful, but now the drawback is so how do we fix that? And then you add and you blend and you invent new fibers.
And Regina, I've been wondering how all of this looks, you know, or looked. Let's say we have nylon. So it was produced here. Was it in the form of a thread, or was it woven, or who did all that?
Well, it was nylon was manufactured in a couple of major DuPont plants, including one in Seaford, Delaware, which is still producing synthetic fibers today with a different company. But it really looks like it's a polymer, and it looks like a gigantic plastic thread that is pulled out of a big vat when it is created, and then this yarn is then woven into ever more finer threads.
Mm-hmm. And now, Genevieve, I want to turn to you because you're about to set out on creating a brand new lab where you will study the future of textiles and design. So talk a bit about that work.
Well, the new advancement in fiber and fiber technology have made it possible to try to embed technology into textiles. So it's a really interesting endeavor. But then there's so many problems related to that. So how do you put textile that can communicate or can conduct electricity without, you know, shocking the body because you need power in order to power your garment and so forth? So there's a lot of new ideas that are called wearable technology or fashionable technology. Fashionable technology is about you take a garment, you embed it with technology, and then you become almost a device yourself.
But what kind of, how would we use that in everyday life?
Well, I think a good place to start in everyday life is with monitoring bodily function in the health industry, for example. So wearable technology could, and there are some garments who have patches that can monitor your heart and can help you, monitor your well-being, if you wish. So that's a good place to start in terms of wearable technology, I think.
But where do you see this going? What could the future of these...
Well, it can go all the way to being extremely expressive. You know, Hussein Chalayan in 2007, he's a fairly famous fashion designer, designed a beautiful, beautiful line of garment that transformed on stage. And so fashion designer, if the technology is well invented for them to later use, which is not different from us using Gore-Tex as fashion designer that was historically invented for NASA. So if we can do that, then it's the imagination alone that will decide where we go with that. So,
Regina, yeah, is there a historical component to that as well?
There is. As I was listening to her talk, I was reflecting on the early 20th century and the fashion industry. When people talk about the fashion industry, they don't often talk about the technologies that made many different types of fashions possible. Silk processing is a technology.
Yes.
Cotton fabric manufacturing involves technology. It involves not only manufacturing the threads, but it involves treating the fabrics in a certain way so that you can gain certain qualities. Technology has always been, fiber and fabric technology has always been key to the fashion industry, and I see Genevieve taking that next step and adapting it to the 21st century.
And that's the voice of Regina Blaszczyk. She studies the history of science and is a visiting scholar at the University of Pennsylvania. And we also have Genevieve Dion. She is a fashion design program director at Drexel University's College of Media, Art and Design. And we're talking history and also some futuristic items in terms of the chemical industry, its impact on fashion, on design, on the textile industry. And Regina, to go back to the historic component for a second, you just spoke about all the technology involved. How big an industry, how big an employer were these two big companies? What was their footprint? We see their names everywhere in this region. So what was their impact on this region?
Yes, in the post-war years, DuPont was the largest chemical manufacturer in the world, and it employed over 100,000 people altogether. And so it was an enormous employer. Roman Haas was a smaller specialty chemical company, employed fewer people, and its footprint in fibers was much smaller. It actually has an interesting story in that it tried to adapt acrylic technology to new fiber manufacturing in the late 1960s and was not successful. It's kind of an interesting story of an experiment that didn't work.
And going forward, how could some of the inventions you're talking about, how could that impact, again, employment in this region? Back then, it seemed like the inventions were happening here, the manufacturing was happening here, everything was happening here. But now, the manufacturing probably wouldn't happen here, right?
It could. Mm-hmm. There are, again, that's what a little bit of what we're looking at with the Shimaseki lab, which is a knitting technology that we've been working with. So right now we're working with a company called Shimaseki USA, who's the world's largest knitting company. And they, you can actually produce a garment locally. Because if you can produce it via the computer and then send a file to the knitting machine, you can start manufacturing here again. And in fact, Shimaseki in New Jersey at the moment work with the small designer in New York and are able to produce 50 pieces for the designer. It's no longer a requirement to produce thousands and thousands of garments in order to be, so you can say, made in USA again,
mm-hmm.
perhaps.
And you see that this could potentially grow then?
It could potentially grow, especially for, there's different things that are advantageous to that, especially in the medical industry, for example. You would need mass customizable types of garments. So you are a particular size, I'm a particular size, so if I get a prescription to have a shirt that monitors my health, it's not about making 100,000 small, medium, and large pieces of garment. It's about making maybe two or three this particular size. So if I can enter the particular size into the computer and then customize my piece for you on a mass custom, you know, a mass producible piece of equipment, then it's an incredible advantage, and it can be made here.
Talk a bit about what your lab looks like. A lot of what you talk about sounds very futuristic. And the manufacturing of it with, is there 3D printers? All that stuff is very far away from my imagination at this point, honestly.
Well, the knitting machines are like 3D printers. So if someone knows what a 3D printer is, so you can imagine that the knitting machine is like a 3D printer.
How big is it?
It's about 7 foot wide and 3 foot deep, and it weighs about 2,000 pounds. There's different types of machine that can do different things. We will have 4 of them in September or a little bit earlier in the lab. Right now, we only have one. But so these machines are, you can just feed one yarn through it, and then you can make a garment. And it's a fascinating process, but it's like a building of... So if you've hand-knitted, it's the same process, except you put that through a machine, and the machine does the knitting for you.
And there's like a sweater that comes out at the
there
end?
There is actually a sweater that comes out in the end, and there is no assembly required. And that's the thing that is really fascinating, because with the new... the new yarn, the new fiber technology, we have, and if you think about embedding electronics into textile, you don't want to solder all of that. So if you can think of a production method that can lay the conductive yarn, make them touch, make the circuit without having to do it all by hand, you can do very, very fine work.
And Regina, you knowing the region's history, is this exciting to you?
Well, it's exciting because it reminds me of the days when DuPont hired craftspeople to work for them designing prototypes of curtains and upholstery and carpets. So it's like you're taking the prototypes and you're making it the new model almost.
Yeah,
it's kind of interesting.
That's what's fascinating about these particular pieces of equipment, where it's a new kind of craft. And it's about using the new textiles, the new fibers, the new yarn, and then applying it to a high craft that the machine can produce, help you produce.
So are we consistently or continuously developing new fibers, or are we still building on that family of fibers that was introduced 80, 90 years ago?
Oh, we're continuously inventing new fibers. There are fireproof fibers now, cut-proof fibers. So safety garments with fiber technology is really pretty amazing. Lightness, too. I mean, all these new fibers incorporate not only... So if you Kevlar can protect you, but it's also very lightweight. So that's an amazing thing. It's about lightness and it's about protection. So I call them the specialized fiber. In the past, I think that the manufactured fiber tried to imitate the natural fibers, and I think that today they have not surpassed them, but they have a new function. And so you can have Vectron that makes a fiber extremely, extremely strong. So you can reinforce fiber quite a bit in that way.
And I know that engineers are working on post-Kevlar fibers, fibers that are even stronger than Kevlar, more bulletproof than Kevlar.
And talk a bit about maybe the importance of sometimes wartime and the military has a huge impact of invention. And when you were just talking about the functions of these fibers, I was again thinking of the military. Reggie, can you weigh in on that? World War II played a big role.
Well, nylon was invented before World War II, but it played an enormous role in World War II and was used, had many military applications, as did the traditional fiber silk. So you're correct to point to that. Those territories can be also explored in looking at plastics and looking at paints as well.
And that's the same today, because if you think about military and chemical warfare and protection, so the new fibers can also speak to the defense.
When I get to fashion, though, in terms of new fibers, what are we looking for there? Is it the lightness you'd mentioned? What else are some new fibers doing that you're excited about from a fashion point of view?
Well, at the moment, we're looking at very much the futuristic fibers. So I'm hoping, you know, it's just we have students who have dreamed of making fibers that so the you can kind of program your dress to change color or to have a different pattern. And so these are the new ideas that we have, or motion sensors for different kinds of dance performances and communication with the audience and so forth. So there's a lot of expressive new ideas that could be put together. So that's really looking into the future. But in order to do that, we have to go back to basic and say, okay, how do we really integrate all of these things into a wearable textile, you know?
I was thinking, as you were talking, I was envisioning a NASCAR driver's jacket. And instead of the stitched-on emblems, I was just envisioning it more looking like Times Square, where it's just scrolling. Would that be possible?
That's what a lot of people are dreaming about. And there are some of the things that are being done at the moment that are like that. It's not completely embedded into textile yet, but it also has incredible interior application for curtain walls and so on and so forth, where you can embed LEDs into textiles and then program them to change. So there's a lot of development into all of these directions.
And so it's funny, because when we're listening back to these commercials from the 60s, they sound just so from a different world almost. But I'm sure in 10 years, what we're doing now might just seem as old to younger kids. Sorry, we're going to take a short break. We can think about that as we go ahead. You're listening to Radio Times, and we're talking about textile industry and the chemical industry, its past and its future in our region. And we'll talk more after a break. You can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. I'm Maiken Scott in for Marty Moskowain, and you're listening to Radio Times.
The College of Graduate Studies at University of the Sciences supports WHYY and offers more than 20 master's, PhD, and certificate programs. Many of their advanced degree programs offer part-time, evening, and online options. University of the Sciences graduate students work alongside faculty who are leaders in fields like biological sciences, chemistry, and health psychology. To learn more, visit University of the Sciences online at gradschool.usciences.edu.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember Barney Rossett, who published Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, Samuel Beckett, and fought censorship with the publication of D.H. Lawrence's Lady Chatterley's Lover and Henry Miller's Tropic of Cancer. Rossett died Tuesday at the age of 89. We'll listen back to a 1991 interview with him. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. A quarter of the labor force will soon be over 55, and companies are realizing it'll take a lot of years to train replacements, so they're finding ways to keep older workers going, like stretching classes. Also, the films that win the Oscar are not always the films that stand the test of time. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscoane. We're talking about the history of the chemical industry and invention in this region and the future of the textile industry and design and fashion and invention again in this region. And we're joined in the studio by Regina Blaszczyk and Geneviève Dion. Blaszczyk studies the history of science as a visiting scholar of the University of Pennsylvania. She's also an award-winning author and historian. And Geneviève Dion is an award-winning designer and artist, and she is fashion design program director at Drexel University's College of Media Art and Design. Let's take a phone call at 1-888-477-9499. We have David joining us from Princeton. Hi, David.
Hello.
You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, my name's Dave. I'm calling from Princeton, New Jersey. I've been listening to your program, and I have something to add regarding the future of, in part, where textiles are, could be headed, derived from natural fibers as combined with synthetic fiber. There's a company in Boulder, Colorado that was founded by an old friend of mine, Greg Hayquist. The company name is Cocona, C-O-C-O-N-A. It is a company that produces a fiber that is a product of, in great part, the coconut shell chemistry makeup, and the coconut shell fibers from the coconut shell interwoven can produce wind and water resistant performance that rivals Gore-Tex, but it's made out of natural fibers.
Thank you, David. That brings up several interesting points, and I want to thank you so much for calling in. Geneviève, are we looking to marry? We've talked a lot about the blends that we used in fabrics. Is that a good way to go, to marry natural fibers with synthetic fibers, or does that only work in specific circumstances?
Well, they're all engineered to perform specific functions. So if this particular coconut, I would assume it's a reconstituted coconut fiber, and if that can rival, you know, Gore-Tex, then perhaps it is. It would be interesting to see what it is and what it's like. I don't know.
And I want to. I guess it also brings up the issue of sustainability.
Yeah.
Because coconut fiber could be an abundant material and fairly cheap. So what are those concerns?
Well, yes, it could. Again, it depends how it's done, because also there's a chemical process that may have to be put through in order to do the coconut fiber, and that we don't know about, because it's not the naturals that are simply harvested, like wool or cotton, don't need chemical processing, but bamboo needs chemical processing. I'm assuming coconut does as well, but it is a renewable fiber, so that's of great interest.
There's been a long-standing interest in renewable fibers. There's a great historical example from the World War II era, in that the dairy companies and the Dairy Institute backed the research on a milk-based fiber called Arylex. And this fiber was produced commercially for a very limited period of time, but it was discovered that milk was really needed to feed people.
Yes.
And there really wasn't enough milk to invest in this new type of alternative natural fiber. So it will be interesting to see how the new company in Boulder, Colorado deals with these questions today.
And what's the role of oil in producing many of these synthetic fibers, whether in the form of an ingredient or as energy. So talk a bit about that, because that has to come to people's minds nowadays.
Well, these the family of synthetic fibers that was popular and introduced in the after the war was a petrochemical-based system. So this does raise questions about sustainability and natural resources that we have to think about in the future.
So, yes, and then there's a lot of experimentation. This is not my expertise, but on renewable and recycling polyester. So you can recycle some of those fibers. You can take plastic bottles and turn them into fibers now. So there's a lot of experimentation with new fibers and to try to actually recycle and renew those fibers as well.
But I guess as a consumer, just because something contains natural fibers doesn't necessarily mean that its impact on the environment is less.
That's true. A lot of people don't realize that natural fibers are processed heavily, and they use cotton, for example, uses a lot of water in processing and growing. It uses chemicals to grow cotton to prevent insects from eating it. You also, in treating the fibers and the textiles, even if they are natural fibers, you do use a lot of chemicals to do that. So it's when you hear the word natural, you have to be cautious about that.
So it's a lot that comes into play. We have another call on this very issue from Mary in Chestnut Hill. Hi, Mary. Thank you for calling Radio Times. Go ahead.
I was just going to bring up the business about these nylon, orlon, acrolon, and all those things are made from oil. So if we can find some, I know it requires water and chemicals to process wool and cotton, but still, they are more easily grown than using the oil from other places.
Thank you, Mary, for that call. And I guess there has to be a search going on right now to reduce the amount of oil needed, especially with oil prices going the way they
are. Again, with the recycling and so on and so forth. The main problem is that we're mass consumers as well. So it's not just about the textile industry. It's providing something that we all want. We all want to buy more clothes, more fabrics, and so forth. I think that, but it's really important to look at alternative methods, and there's a lot of research being done. I don't think there's one answer, though.
And I do, we don't have that much time left, but I have to talk to you about some of the work you do, Geneviève Dion. That's more your artistic and design work. And the technique you use in your work, I've looked at some of the pictures of your work, and you're wearing a beautiful scarf top that is very, it has a lot of little folds and it's very textural in its design. So talk a bit about the technique you use in your own work.
Well, what I was interested in, and I guess that's in some ways ties into this new work, is the fascination I've always had is to construct things without seams and to sculpt fabric. So as an artist and in the work that I did, it was about pleating and fabric. And when I was doing that, I discovered a process of permanently pleating silk. And so the fabric, the silk can be pleated, it can be washed, and it's forever comes back. It's permanent. And it's a very rare technique. Not very many people, if any, know how to do that. You can produce that with synthetic. You can heat set it and it melts and then it has a permanence, but with natural fiber is not that easy to do. So that's process oriented, I guess. And that's why this new work is also very interesting to me, because it's about the process. How do we put all of these things together to turn them into a product that has integrity and is well designed?
And do you have time with everything that you're doing?
No.
So interesting. So your artwork is not getting...
Well, it's a new chapter in my life and in research. So I don't think I don't have time for my work anymore. My work has shifted to another place.
And we have another call from Regina in Bala Cynwyd. Hi, Regina. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, hello.
Hello.
I have noticed that many of the garments that people buy these days and also household fabrics are made in China. So I'm wondering, are the Chinese buying our fibers and fabrics, or are they manufacturing their own?
I suspect that they're manufacturing their own.
Yeah. And that brings me to a question. When people invented these different things, I'm sure there was patent law that came into play. So how long did that stay with the product, or did people just copy the process? How did that work out?
It's a really complicated story, and it's a great story. You have to realize that innovation happens in increments. And so in the fibers business, there are important patents, but those patents run out. And after a certain point in time, it becomes easy for competitors to jump in and to copy the technology. So it's like fashion in many respects, mm-hmm. in that all you have to do is change a little tiny color or button, and you're not infringing on someone's rights.
20%.
So it's very complicated.
What's that?
20% of 5 to 10% of the patent needs to be different, and then it's not infringement.
And what you're doing in your lab now, is this a fiercely competitive field? You have to be
very
careful.
It's very secretive and it's very competitive. But I think also what's really interesting to me to have something like this at a university setting and with the collaboration with engineers and medicine and so forth is that we are looking for broader answers that and. Maybe at a university level, because we publish, we can start to develop a larger network to solve some of the massive problems that are related with wearable technology.
And what kind of a group of people do you have to have in a room? I'm thinking you need a chemist, you need an artist, you need designers. I mean, it just seems to bring together a really diverse group of people.
Yeah, this is one thing that has been quite wonderful into working with the idea of wearable technology. If we tried to do it ourselves, then we ended up trying to make little circuits that by hand that didn't look so good, and we didn't quite understand what was going on. So now we work with biotechnology, material engineers, and then we talk about the properties, and then we try to find a common language. So sitting together in a room takes some time so that we start to understand each other, but it's also a fascinating experiment, if you wish, because then now we're starting to really understand what each other can bring to the table, and really it sparks new ideas.
It's not so different when the major fiber companies here in the United States were developing their markets in the 50s and 60s. They depended extensively on feedback from the customers, from the textile mills that bought the fibers, from the carpet mills that bought the fibers, and they would get feedback from architects, from interior designers. So it's like you're recreating the same space, this creative space, this give and take that's such an important part of innovation.
Yes, and Drexel is really trying to do that. We're putting together a next site center, which is also about creating innovation and bringing arts, sciences together, and designers and engineering and medicine. So then you have a think tank that is going to help bring new economies, we hope, to the region.
And Reggie, what's next for you? You've taken a lot of time in your career studying the history of design, of the chemical industry, of all those things. What do you want to look at next?
Well, I was very excited to be part of this program today because my next project is going to be looking at the history of the American fashion industry from a technological perspective. So I'm very interested in the role of dyes and fibers and even the department store as a machine for selling.
How so? Talk a bit about that.
Well, here we have in Philadelphia one of the most important department stores in the United States, the John Wanamaker Company, which was a pioneer in many aspects of marketing and innovation. People don't realize that department stores were, for example, the first businesses to retailer to adopt electricity, to adopt new methods of information management, and so on and so forth. And so I see these connections between retailing and fashion and technology as being very important, and that's what I want to explore in my new work.
And Genevieve, we only have a short moment left, but in terms of, as a consumer, what can I look for? What is going to come out maybe within the next couple of years that will really change how we look at technology, fashion, fabric, all of those things? What are some things that you think could happen fairly quickly?
I'm thinking probably the monitor, the shirt that can monitor your heart rate and so forth. I think that's going to be, there's a lot of prototype that we see. There's a few things missing for them to be on the market yet, but they're very close to be there. But those that are truly completely integrated, where you barely know the difference, you're wearing an embedded electronic shirt, and then you barely know that you have any electronics on you. I don't know how long that's going to take.
What's the biggest challenge there? Is it the source of power, the battery?
Power is a big challenge, and also. The components are still hard components, even as small as they may be. You still need to put them onto the shirt, and so you still have hard components, and we're trying to get rid of that.
But you think, are consumers ready for this?
There's a lot of it's going to be an interesting challenge. I don't know. The human factor connected to that are incredibly big. It's a big thing. But I think some people want it. So
we'll
the
see.
Athlete.
Yeah, athletes. Yes, that sounds like an emerging market there. And with that, we're going to have to close. And I want to thank you both so much for joining us today. Regina Blaszczyk studies the history of science as a visiting scholar at the University of Pennsylvania. She's also an author and a historian. Geneviève Dion is fashion design program director at Drexel University's College of Media, Art and Design, where she's launching a brand new lab where she'll be studying all these exciting things. I'm Mike and Scott. I'm filling in for Marty Moss. Kuwain today, and going out, I want to hear a song from a Philadelphia 60s vocal group, the Orlans, who of course got their name from the DuPont synthetic fiber. So with that, we'll go, and thank you so much for listening.
18th and 19th on Chestnut Street.
Come on over tonight.
On Chestnut Street.